From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Last month, Google announced that the hacking attacks it and other companies had experienced originated in China. Well, now, according to a story in today's New York Times, investigators looking into those attacks have linked them to two Chinese schools. One is a university, and the other is a vocational school. Reporter John Markoff, who covers technology and computer security for The Times, joins us from the paper's San Francisco bureau. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Robert.
And you report that the schools are Shanghai Jiaodong University and Langshan Vocational School. What do you know about these schools?
Well, the school in Shanghai is sort of the equivalent of the MIT of China. It has a world-class computer science program. The vocational school was started by a former member of the People's Liberation Army. And it does feed students into the military. It's large, but it's more like a state school. It's not an elite school.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say the school feeds some students into the military. People had wondered if these attacks had not originated with the Chinese military. Does your story suggest that they didn't?
You know, I think we're still very much in a wilderness of mirrors. Google said they had some confidence that the intrusions came from China, but it did not give any meaningful detail. What was known before this from other companies that were involved in the investigation was that there were trails leading back to Taiwan, where some of the command and control servers for the intrusions were, and to a computer server center in Texas. And this basically takes the trail one step back, albeit to the Chinese mainland.
When we speak of this investigation, by the way, what kind of investigation is this that you're reporting on?
Well, I think that the visibility into the investigation is limited, at least by me. We know that Google contacted the National Security Agency and asked for help in the days after it went public with the intrusions. We know that law enforcement is involved, and we know that the companies themselves are trying to do detective work to find out ultimately where the intrusions came from.
You report that in one case there's been a link made not just to a school, but to a particular class taught by a particular teacher.
Yes, I mean, I still have to say that I don't know the name of the teacher. I was simply told that investigators had found some linkage to a particular class at the vocational school and that the class was taught by a computer scientist from Kiev.
Well, what have you heard about what I guess might be the most benign explanation for these attacks, which is on the level of student prank or misbehavior? Is the level of the attack such that they could have been uncoordinated by a handful of very gifted computer undergraduates, say?
Probably not. There are aspects of the intrusions that suggest great sophistication. And so the fact that the flaws that they used to gain initial entry were not publicly known, were not known by anybody, even by Microsoft. I mean, the initial intrusion vector was through a version of Microsoft's web browser. That is the kind of expertise that suggests a professional attacker.
So far as you know, is the hacking still going on, or has it stopped, or is someone lying low? What do you hear?
I have not heard of new intrusions, although people have found evidence of fingerprints, so there is forensic information to be gathered.
Are we likely to see any more formal public result of this investigation, or is it something that's likely to be kept quiet for a long time?
You know, I've heard this is extremely sensitive. The U.S. government is involved. Google has said that they intend to negotiate or discuss things with the Chinese, and I think what we will hear in a way, depends on the outcome of those discussions.
And do you know if the Chinese are cooperating at all so far in the investigation?
I do not, but I don't believe so.
Okay. John Markoff, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's reporter John Markoff, who covers technology and computer security for the New York Times.
Two mystery thrillers with increasingly paranoid heroes open this week, and each is directed by a filmmaking legend, Martin Scorsese and Roman Polanski. Scorsese's Shutter Island, set in 1954, stars Leonardo DiCaprio and a cast that includes Ben Kingsley, Michelle Williams, and Max von Sydow. Polanski's The Ghostwriter, a much more contemporary story, stars Ewan McGregor and Pierce Brosnan. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The two new movies by Martin Scorsese and Roman Polanski make for a study in contrasts, an incredibly depressing one. That's because Scorsese's film is dead on the screen, while Polanski's simmers with a passion for storytelling. And guess which director is unlikely to make another movie? Scorsese's Shutter Island is closely based on Dennis Lehane's novel about a Boston detective, played on screen by Leonardo DiCaprio, who travels to an island hospital for the criminally insane to investigate the disappearance of a female patient. The novel is a slight but engrossing doodle about illusion or delusion versus reality, a bit like Paul Auster, but more Freudian. For Lehane, it was a breather between Mystic River and his panoramic Any Given Day, but Scorsese draws it out to 2 hours and 19 minutes of tracking shots and bombastic music and shrieking storms and detectives in long coats and fedoras trudging past leering mental patients. Without giving anything away, it's fair to say what seem like over-the-top tropes from 40s and 50s noir are meant to evoke old movies, to seem artificial. But even when the Hollywood detective story foundation begins to crumble and the gumshoe protagonist is racked with visions of concentration camps and bloody children and Nazi experiments, Shutter Island is still suffocatingly movie-ish. Many filmmakers, when they hit their 60s, pare down their styles and strive to be simpler and more direct. But Scorsese has become more impersonal, more like the big-budget studio director he so palpably wasn't when he helped transform American cinema. Here, he visually invokes a score of movies, from The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari to Laura to Frederick Wiseman's graphic asylum documentary Titicut Follies, and there isn't an image that feels organic. Despite a lot of heavy emotional lifting by DiCaprio and fun turns by Mark Ruffalo and Ben Kingsley as an oddly paternal head psychiatrist, it's all like window displays in a movie museum. Or a movie morgue. Polanski, whatever his off-screen travails, both as victim and victimizer, is all there in The Ghostwriter, in audaciously timely, paranoid political conspiracy mystery. Ewan McGregor plays a writer for hire who's drafted at the last minute, his predecessor mysteriously drowned, to rework the much-anticipated memoirs of an ex-prime minister named Lang, obviously Tony Blair, and played by Pierce Brosnan. Lang is reviled by his countrymen for hitching his country to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and he's now under investigation by an international human rights tribunal for turning over suspects to the CIA for torture. The media descends on his U.S. refuge on an estate in an empty, wintry Martha's Vineyard, where the PM and his severe wife, played by Olivia Williams, and perky aide, played by Kim Cattrall, consider the most prudent course of action.
If it suits them, they will hang you out to dry. You need a lawyer. Call Sid.
Get Sid on the line.
What about the media?
Issue a holding statement, something short.
Oh, this is what we need, Mike.
I'll write something.
Let him do it. He's supposed to be the writer.
Well, hang on a minute.
I should say I'm confident. Not defensive. That'd be fatal. But I shouldn't be cocky. No bitterness, no anger. And don't say I'm pleased at this opportunity to clear my name or any balls like that.
So you're not defensive, but you're not cocky. You're not angry, but you're not pleased.
That's it.
Then what exactly are you?
Told you it was funny.
The title character is funny, and Ewan McGregor has never been better. He's cheeky, yet also watchful, increasingly edgy, and his eyes are as alive as Polanski's camera. The movie, based on a novel by Robert Harris, is perfect Polanski material. The loner hero is spiritually isolated, trapped in vast spaces, on dunes and rain-swept beaches, under low, threatening skies, and unable to move without being watched. There's an undercurrent of lust, too, a ghoulish attraction between McGregor and the seething, joyless Olivia Williams. The Ghostwriter is not especially realistic in its depiction of anti-war protesters descending on the British PM everywhere in the U.S. Such protests didn't come near to major politicians, even in the war's heyday. But Polanski's touch is so sure that the film is entrancing to the last tumultuous frame. There's more than a touch of Hitchcock, but Polanski makes the fluid, paranoid style his own, inorganic expressionism that dwarfs Scorsese's third-rate horrors in Shutter Island.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
Tonight at the Vancouver Olympics, the sequin, feather, and satin extravaganza known as ice dancing. Or was that last night in the men's free skate, when American Evan Lysacek took gold, dethroning the 2006 gold medalist Russian Yevgeny Plushenko. And the Russian was so indignant about that result that he said, now it's not men's figure skating, now it's dancing. Here to decode this battle and to talk about some of the more outrageous costumes we've seen on the ice is sports writer Jeri Longman of the New York Times in Vancouver for his 10th Olympics. Jeri, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
The issue here, Evan Lysacek did not have a quadruple jump. Yevgeny Plushenko did, and he says that the difficulty of his program and that jump should have brought him the gold. That's now the big debate in the skating world.
Plushenko looks at figure skating the way Shaun White looks at snowboarding, that for the sport to evolve, you have to have bigger and more daring tricks all the time, whereas Evan Lysacek is adhering to the new points-based system that rewards completeness over the big trick. He was better in spins and footwork and things like that that sort of connect the jumps. So I think he deserved to win.
Well, Jeri, let's move on to what's really important here in ice skating. That is, of course, the costumes. You've been blogging about them a lot, and I want to start with these two top medalists. Evan Lysacek skated last night all in black, but with these thick silver sequin snakes wrapped around his body. What'd you think?
Well, it's better than a short program. You know, these are Vera Wang costumes, but she had him dressed as a magpie in this short program. You know, he's the Vera Wang channeling her inner Heckle and Jekyll, I think. Thankfully, he had fewer feathers on in the long program.
And his rival, the Russian Plushenko, was wearing this costume. And I have to say, as soon as my producer and I saw it, we both texted each other immediately with the words light bright, because it looked just like that toy with those plastic tubes that light up.
It reminded me of something out of Guys and Dolls. It was, but those were some of the more sedate costumes.
That's
I mean, there
true.
Was a guy, Adrian Schulteis from Sweden, who actually pulled this off. His music was Insane in the Brain, the rap song by Cypress Hill. So he dressed in a straight jacket as imagined by a waiter at an Asian fusion restaurant. But
wow.
He actually carried it off.
We've got to talk about Johnny Weir, the ever flamboyant Johnny Weir, who did not disappoint on Tuesday in the short program. He had this kind of patent leather bustier, shocking pink straps. He was rocking the tassel on his shoulder. Last night, I gotta say, he was kind of elegant and disappointingly so.
Well, at the national championships, he had a fox fur patch on his shoulder, but he heard from, you know, protests from animal rights groups, so he removed it. So there were some wild lynx spotted on the downhill and the luge course around here the other day, and people were joking that they were running for their lives, hoping not to become part of Johnny's outfit for this free skate.
Oh, dear. What did you think about his costume last night?
That was fine. You know, the thing about Johnny is he both sort of celebrates and makes fun of this outrageousness at the same time. He gets it, and I really appreciate him, because I think he's sort of spoofing it all at the same time as that he's taking part in it.
Jeri, when you look back at, say, Scott Hamilton from 1984 when he took gold, he's wearing just a red, white, and blue unitard like a speed skater would. When did men's costumes sort of go down this crazy road?
Alexei Urmanov, the Russian 1990 champion, began wearing gloves and you know, came from a very balletic tradition. You know, the costumes from that point got more outrageous, so now you have, you know, the plunging necklines, the off-the-shoulder collars, the sequins, the fur, and, you know, and then there are the women. So.
Jeri Longman of the New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.